Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s. It's myself, Martin, along with Noel again. How you doing, Noel?
Very good, mate. Very good.
Now, Noel, as you know, we're starting to come to the end of season one of the Uncharted 80s. And don't worry, everybody, because season two's coming with some tracks and some treats from the 90s. How exciting
Indeed.
is that, Noel?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, look, today's band is what I would call the sort of definitive Uncharted 80s band. You know, we've talked about a few of those over the season, and I would say they fit that bill perfectly. Some people may know them, some people may not know their music, may know they've heard their name, but they may not know their whole story. And Noel, it's That Petrol Emotion.
Cool, excellent.
The band were around from sort of 83, 84 to 94. So like this sort of 10, 11 year period. Now, there is also a bit of a reunion, which we'll get into later on. And the band were Steve Mack on vocals, John O'Neill on guitar, Raymond Gorman on guitar, Damien O'Neill on bass guitar, and Kira McLaughlin on drums. Now, Raymond Gorman on guitar, the great news about today, Noel, is that we'll be talking to Raymond later on in the episode. So
looking forward to that, yeah.
He can add some colour to our black and white view of the band.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Following the split of the Undertones, John O'Neill, who was the sort of band's former guitarist and sort of, I guess you'd call him the principal songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote Teenage Kicks, which is obviously, you know, the classic Undertones song, which is, of course, John Peel's favourite ever song. So actually, it's interesting because I think in 84, you know, Paul Whitehouse, the comedian.
Yeah, I do.
He actually auditioned for the band in 84. And actually, he actually said in more recent years that he was unsuccessful. He mentioned that he tried, but actually didn't get into the band. So that's interesting, isn't it?
Good fun fact that. Maybe the John Peel influence was there because in 85, they got their first John Peel session.
Right, yeah. I mean, I guess, obviously, he was a massive fan of the Undertones. So once he heard those guys had another band, he must have been well up for doing another session for them.
They then released their first single, the debut single, which was called Keen, and that was on Pink Records. And obviously, you start to see a little bit more of that Petrol Emotion seem to be a little bit more open to being political and a bit more outspoken than maybe the Undertones had been.
Yeah, I think the Undertones were were kind of like, obviously they all grew up in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and the Undertones, I think, almost decided deliberately to not even get into that at all and just create a kind of alternative view about teenage angst and growing up and girls and all that kind of stuff, which is what they did very successfully. But I think that Petrol Emotion said, do you know what, we're going to tackle some of this stuff in our songs now. And
so John O'Neill, I think, was once again the sort of principal songwriter, although to be fair, it seems like there was contributions from all of them.
Yeah.
But they had a second single in 85 too, which is called V2. And they put that out on their own Noise & Noise label. But they then got another John Peel session back end of 85 in November with a particularly good song called, they had four songs in that thing, but one of the songs was called Tight Lipped.
Throughout for that period, obviously, they started gigging and obviously sort of promoting themselves. And they actually, in 85, had been supporting Echo and the Bunnymen on a few dates. They then went on in later years to support James and lots of other bands. And they also supported Iggy Pop on a European tour. But what was interesting is that when they played in the UK, actually, the lineup was changed around. So they were the headliners that Iggy supported.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's great. So we get into sort of 86, and that's when they got their first full album, Manic Pop Thrill,
classic.
Which, if anybody hasn't heard that album, it's definitely worth a listen. It's got some absolute cracking tunes on it. And then you're into 87, you know, they start to do a bit more touring, and then their second album, Babble, which is the one that had the single, which probably was the one that came closest to charting, I guess, called Big Decision. Did get to number 42 in the chart, Noel.
Okay.
And that was pretty much their peak, I guess, in terms of chart. But interestingly enough, we were saying about the political element of the band.
Yes.
Well, the back sleeve of Big Decision had got some text criticising the Diplock courts in Northern Ireland. Around about 25, 27 years later, Raymond Gorman actually started. So maybe this is a good conversation for, you know, question for Raymond.
Yeah.
He said that once we started talking about politics, you know, the music almost became secondary.
I get that. It's just like a focus for them. Yeah, makes sense. I know that in 87, for the second consecutive year, they played Glastonbury Festival. And actually, they did quite a few festivals, actually. The same year, they played Roskilde in Denmark. But they went on to play some other festivals, lots of other festivals, actually, including Reading, Tea in the Park, Electric Picnic, and twice at the Fela Festival in Ireland. So they did a lot of festival stuff as well.
Our old friend, the record company, comes into play here.
Yeah.
So the band just didn't get any more hit singles or close to being hit singles. And that then led to problems with Polydor, where, you know, the management's changed. And they made demands for them to deliver those hit singles. And then Virgin snapped them up, who said that they would support them and perhaps give them a bit more freedom in terms of what they needed to do. That then led on to a single called Genius Move, which actually was really well received. Robert Smith from The Cure made it his single of the week. I'm not quite sure what he was doing at that point, but must have been doing some...
Yeah, Record Mirror or one of those.
Column or something. But Genius Move was sort of banned from being aired on the BBC due to there was a reference on the sleeve artwork to Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin politician, who at that point in time, his voice had been banned from the media between sort of 88 and 94. So we then come into back into sort of towards the into 88, where they had an album called The Millennium Psychosis Blues.
Just when John left the band.
It is. Now, this was one of those albums that seemed to split the fans, the critics,
because
it seemed to have a huge amount of variation, lots of different sort of styles on the album, albeit actually has got some great songs. It also had a what they call a Celtic ballad called Cellophane.
That was a single, wasn't it? Again, Cellophane.
Yeah, after Genius Move, yeah. In later years, it's sort of been reappraised a little bit. Maybe the band were a bit before their time, you know, and maybe they were even sort of trailblazers for that Britpop and, you know, indie dance scene, you know, that was happening. Now, on the eve of the recording of that album, John O'Neill announced that he was going to leave the band. So although he stayed to record the album, I think from what I can ascertain is that those sessions to make that album were pretty tense.
Yeah, you know? They don't sound like a lot of fun, do they? If you've got that going on, hanging in the air. Yeah, so in 89, I read a really interesting thing, actually. So in 89, they were involved or part of a significant historical event, probably in modern history, actually. So, the Baltic states as we know them now, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, they were under Soviet Union. They were still owned part of the Soviet Union, and in fact they didn't get independence until 1991. But in the mid 80s, when Gorbachev got to power, he started talking about things like glasnost, which means openness, and perestroika, which means restructuring. So this kind of reawakened and the nationalist kind of feeling in those countries I talked about. And one of the big things that went on, part of that whole movement, was within Estonia. They started a concert, like a festival. It started in 88. It was called Summer Rock, but it became known as Glasnost Rock. It's primarily Estonian bands, but a handful of like UK bands got involved. And the following year, that Petrol Emotion played there. And it was so popular, 150,000 people attended over 3 days, and they played to over 80,000 people. Imagine that.
Wow. So they obviously at the back, because John O'Neill had left, they had a little bit of a reshuffle within the band. John Marchini, who'd covered on guitar, joined actually on bass, which then allowed Damien O'Neill to switch back to guitar again. You know, Raymond Kieran and Damien were then started to take over the sort of songwriting again.
Right, yeah.
That then led to, in sort of 1990, that led to the album Chemi Crazy. Interesting enough, produced by Scott Litt, who had worked with REM. And once again, that album, you know, personally, I felt the band were getting better and better. You know, they'd got sort of a number of singles there, Sensitize, Tingle, and Hey Venus.
sure for sure and actual. You swear by all that's factual. Insane, elastic, joy, despair. Figures dancing, bebop. Take me away from the drop. I cannot help but stand and stare. Sawdust, casanovas. I'm dying to take over. Lipstick on bankroll, it's a deal.
I think there was sort of quite heavy predicted sales for that album, and that unfortunately didn't happen. Sort of stalled in the charts at 62, and that then unfortunately led to the inevitable ending of the band's contract with Virgin.
Yeah,
feels like that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, so it was interesting because when I was doing my little bit of research as well, in 1990, and one of the bands that we had recently on the podcast, and a very popular podcast actually, The Men They Couldn't Hang. They actually appeared on the bill a lot of times with that Petrol Emotion. So in 1990, that Petrol Emotion, one of the support acts, along with The Men They Couldn't Hang, to your favourite band, or one of them, The Stranglers,
oh,
at Alexander
yes.
Palace. Yeah.
Love them.
So, and in fact, they appeared with The Men They Couldn't Hang on the same bill several times, including Reading Festival, Glastonbury, and a festival called Phoenix Festival that I went to, which was to see Carter USM. Great little festival. But yeah, so their paths crossed quite a lot.
So that Alexander Palace lineup,
yeah,
in 1990. Now, that's interesting in itself, because that was the final concert that Hugh Cornwell played with the Stranglers.
Oh, wow.
And he left the band immediately after that. So we're into the sort of 1993. We move forward. Their last studio album, which was called Fireproof. And once again, that actually did get to number one in the UK indie chart, interestingly enough. But once again, very positive press coverage, but unfortunately didn't quite make it. Had a great song on there called Detonate My Dreams.
Sounds like they're not getting the commercial success that they wanted, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds like all the record companies wanted what they wanted. It was just slowly going, dialing backwards in a way.
Yeah, I think so. And it got into 94. That's when the bands split. And there is a documentary of their farewell concerts that they did in London and Dublin, which they did actually release as an album called Final Frame in 2000. The O'Neill Brothers, back end of the 90s, 99, they reunited in a reformed Undertones with a different singer to Fergal Sharkey. For 2008, Steve Mack, the singer, announced that they were going to reform in that Fireproof lineup to play some reunion concerts in the summer. They carried on, played a few more festivals. They did a UK tour in 2009.
Cool.
And then in 2010, it seems that the band have been on what we now know as an indefinite break, an indefinite hiatus, I think they call it. And it looks like Steve Mack, the singer, had chosen to sort of stay in Seattle and concentrate on raising a family.
Right, yeah.
So, and although the band, some of the band members carried on working with each other, at least three or four of the band have formed a new band, which is going today, which is called The Everlasting Year. So I'm sure Raymond will we'll talk about that when we have a chat with him. And bringing you right up to date, Noel, in 2022, there was a sort of box set that was issued called Every Beginning Has a Future. And that was their anthology for 10 years, 84 to 94, of all the band's albums, along with some B-sides and live tracks and so on. That's the story of the band, Noel. So why don't we hear a bit more about them through Raymond Gorman and have a chat with Raymond. Raymond, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
No worries at all.
Always happy to talk about the Pedals.
As are we. So could you just tell us a little bit about your background and then perhaps how you came to know like the O'Neill Brothers and things?
Well, I was at school with Damien, so Damien's probably the person I know the longest and I'm still friendly with. We were both at this mixed primary school, girls and boys, which was kind of quite rare. And also the school, this primary school was amazing. They really gave a lot of emphasis to the arts, you know, so we did drama and music and stuff. So Damien was at the school as well. But the both of us got taken out of this school when we were 7, 1968, which was obviously a very kind of pivotal year for a lot of things. And we both were sent to these kind of like boys only schools. And I think we both sort of struggled because, you know, the original primary school, it was just like, it was so nice and everybody there was so nice and stuff. Whereas I went to this boys only primary school and got bullied and, oh, it was just horrible. It took me a while to fit in. I actually decided I'm going to have to get good at something here to kind of make some friends and stuff. So that's when, I was always into football, but I thought I could see, you know, if you're anyway good at football, you know, you'll be a bit more popular. So I really worked hard. I really loved George Best for Manchester United. So I was like, he was my kind of inspiration. So then I didn't see Damien. Well, Damien then we both went to grammar school in Derry as well. So I knew from then. And obviously he left school and I went on and went to university and stuff. But so he'd been the Undertones. So Undertones obviously was a big deal for music fans in Derry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I couldn't get, they used to play this place called the Casbah, which was basically a porta cabin. So I always looked really young. And so I couldn't get in. My mates could get in. But the thing about it is, if you stood outside, you could hear perfectly well, you know. And then there's another place, and they moved the kind of Casbah, I don't know, they moved from there. I went to this other place called the Rock Club, which was in the seediest part of town, you know. But I finally got in there. So that felt fantastic. And the thing about Damien was, I would go off to university, but then when I came back, you know, he might be off because the Undertones never toured as much as they probably should have. So I'd see him around town, and obviously I was like really, really into music, and I'd be asking him all the time, you know, and finding out his stories about being on tour with the Clash and stuff. And like he would tell me everything. And he told me an interesting thing later. And he would say to me, you're one of the few people ever used to ask me questions. A lot of people didn't want to ask him things. It was almost like, you know, in Derry, you know, I suppose Derry is like a lot of places, you know, people, they want to kind of keep you in your place. They don't want to, you know, if they think you got a bit of a big head about what you're doing, you know, they'll really try to put you down in size. But it meant for him, you know, he was doing all these amazing things, but like people weren't kind of asking him a lot about it, you know, so I was finding out everything. And then he actually moved to London. I went down to see the Undertones. It was just before they broke up. They were playing this concert. There was this festival on down to South Ireland. Me and my friend hitched down, and I got drunk and somehow passed out and got taken backstage. I missed the Undertones gig, but they put me on their bus back to Derry. So I landed back in Derry about 4:30 in the morning or something, and I couldn't go home because, you know, I was supposed to be at this festival. So I actually ended up staying with John O'Neill and his wife Caroline, and that's when I first sort of met them. And then when I came back from university, I got friendly with John again. Like Damien would be in, he would be in London at this time. He'd gone and after Undertones started another band that didn't work out. So I got friendly with John, and he was a bit down after the Undertones, but we started to just hang out together and sort of play each other records. And I was just really passionate and enthusiastic about music, and I was actually playing in a local band called Bam Bam and the Column, and John saw me play with them, and I think he saw something in me that I didn't even see in myself. I was quite happy playing with Bam Bam, but he said after we were doing this kind of, we were doing this disco club night, God, it's really hard to describe that to young people now, isn't it? It was like three of us would take turns playing records, but we took it quite seriously. we would sort of work out a kind of list of the records we could play. So it meant that you could take turns DJing, but also go out and dance and chat to your friends and stuff and have a drink as well. So it was a brilliant thing.
Yeah,
And
sounds great.
it was, but you know, in Derry, there wasn't that many people that were interested in the kind of music that we were into. But we basically played anything that was good, you know. But we were even playing like, you know, the beginning of hip hop and electro and stuff like that. But we'd play like reggae and we'd play like sort of punk new wave stuff as well. And it became like a kind of religion for the 50 or so people who came all the time. And even whenever we stopped doing it just before we moved to London, and there's people crying.
Oh, God.
But it was like, you know, you can imagine when you're young and you're really into a type of music that's not being, you know, played on daytime radio or nighttime a lot. It really means something, you know. So it was
Yeah.
a whole band of people and friends. And a lot of people actually, whenever we moved to London, they kind of followed us over. They'd be working on the Bolton sites and stuff. And then the Bam Bam actually came over for a while as well. After I left, they kind of became more like a kind of REM type band and made a couple of singles, but then they ended up going back as well. So John and I did a demo 4-track. We did like 9 songs for a 4-track demo. And our friend Mickey Rooney, who also did the was a DJ, he had been in Coventry, Holly, and he knew this woman called Elaine, who came over to Derry, and her partner then, now husband, was a guy called Dick Green, whose friend Alan McGee. So Alan McGee heard
Right.
John was starting another band. So he sent him a letter and said, if you come to London, we'll put out a single. So that's why me and John decided to go to London. And then we got Kieran, the drummer. In the meantime, he heard that we were doing stuff and he had already dipped for the Undertones. Like for me, he dipped with the Undertones when he was like 15.
Wow.
In like in a European tour that Billy Doherty was always leaving apparently. So Kieran would always dip for him. And you can see there's a footage, if you go on YouTube, there's footage of Kieran playing the Undertones when he's only 15, 16 or something. Really amazing.
Wow.
So we got Kieran, so it was three of us went to London. Damien heard the demo and he wanted in and he was happy to even join on bass. That's why he was on bass originally, because he just wanted to be a part of it. His band 11 that he'd started with Mickey Bradley in London, it just kind of fallen apart, didn't really work out. So we had four of us, and then we ended up getting Steve Mac. Took a while to get Steve Mac, and it was only John O'Neill that really wanted Steve in the beginning. We didn't think he was good enough, but he kind of willed himself to become great within about 6 months, I think, you know. And we liked him as a person, obviously, but just, you know, it took a while for everything to come together. It seemed like a long time at the time, but it was like less than a year. So we really kind of got going. So actually, when we recorded Keen, the first single, I was actually the singer. I was a singer for the early days, but I kind of knew because I was, you know, I was playing guitar as well. And there was a couple of songs that couldn't do both. Like Damien would sing a couple of songs, so we knew we wanted a sort of a figurehead, a front man, or whatever. We tried out a girl singer, didn't work out, and a few weirdos it turned up as well. Paul Whitehouse actually auditioned for us. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, that's an amazing little fact. We
Well,
saw that,
we
yeah.
only found out, obviously, once he said it, we remembered this guy, Paul, because he was hilarious, as you can imagine. We were so close to letting him join, even though we didn't really think he was a brilliant singer. He was more like a karaoke singer. You know, he could carry a tune. I mean, you know, we know the thing now. His mum was an opera singer and everything as well. But he was so funny. We nearly let him join because of that. But I'd love to see him today. You know, I'd love to go and talk to him because whenever he told that anecdote on the fishing program with Bob Mortimer, Fergal Shirky was on, and Fergal Shirky cut off. If you listen back to the interview, it's on YouTube. Fergal Shirky cuts off his anecdote because Fergal, obviously, there's animosity still between Fergal and the rest of the Undertones, you know, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
But he cut off the anecdotes. You know, Paul was starting to tell a story about, you know, doing when he came to audition, and then he just cut off the anecdotes. We don't know what else he was going to say, unfortunately.
Oh, wow. How interesting.
That's it. So
That's amazing.
we're up to Keen now. Yeah.
Yes. Brilliant. What were those early days like?
I found the first year, it's really funny that like I've just it's the 40th anniversary of us coming to London. We came in October 84. And, you know, if you can imagine, we're coming from Derry. We had this little kind of very close-knit scene, which was great fun. We were going out, you know, we had no responsibilities, going out 4 nights a week. Then we come over here, and obviously Kieran and I are on the dole. And John and Damien had a bit of money still from the Undertones, so they're okay. And Steve Mack was working at a pizza restaurant. It was a bit grim the first 6 months, especially. Were really grim because, you know, we were practicing. But, you know, once we started playing, things got easier, obviously. And then, you know, you got to meet people, and then we built up a following pretty quickly. And from then on, it was great. It really was. You know, the early days are always maybe the best fun because, you know, there's no business involved as such. You know, you're just playing for the fun of it. And in those days, you know, obviously you could we could play around London. There was loads of different venues. You know, you could play in different parts of London. It didn't matter. Nobody was saying, oh, you can't, you've got to wait months, you know, before you do another gig or whatever. I think it was just a lot easier to be in a band then, obviously. I think it's especially for working people with a working class background, you know.
Did you deliberately try and distance yourself from the Undertone sound? I know your songwriting became more, say, political, but you addressed issues more than the Undertones would, Was
Well,
that a
we
deliberate
didn't. I mean, yeah, if
step?
you listen to the words, a lot of Petrol songs, they're you know, they're a lot of there's a lot of kind of stuff being cloaked there. You know, we were trying to stay away from like doing the obvious thing, really, you know. And I think there's probably too much emphasis put in that. Well, all we wanted to do was to put the information on the sleeves, so you get the information about Northern Ireland, and it was all civil rights stuff. There's nothing contentious there,
No,
really.
no, no, no.
But we wanted the music to be kind of on its own merits. I mean, it was just, I mean, I'm just a heavier player, I suppose. It's not all up to me. I mean, if you think, like, when I saw the Undertones in the early days, the Undertones were as loud as the Petrels in the early days. Their sound got really cleaned up for the first Undertones LP.
Right.
Really cleaned up. And from then on, and I think it kind of suffered a bit as well.
Yeah, I get
Cleaned
that.
it up too much almost.
Yeah, we interviewed the record producer actually produced some of those first albums for the Undertones. So that was quite interesting chatting to him. He loved working with them,
Bashirian?
Yeah,
Yeah,
Roger
Roger,
Bajarian.
You know, I
He
mean,
loved them.
you know, I think that's what they, I know that's what John wanted. John always wanted to be pop, you know, John wanted to be in the charts. But I think, you know, it was the same with the Buzzcocks, you know, there was this, there's a kind, I think there's a limited kind of market for stuff that we really love. Maybe there's something in that as well. You know, because you know, if you really want to get into the top 10, it's like, it's very rare that you, except maybe like the Sex Pistols or something, you know, and obviously maybe that's like a one-off, you know, the Clash, you know, stuff that we love that doesn't really, it doesn't really kind of do well commercially. I mean, I remember being very disappointed once the Buzzcocks started sort of slipping out of the charts. You know, their heyday didn't really last very long when you
No,
think.
they were great. They were great.
They were brilliant, yeah, of course they were. It's hard to say, really, you know, but I think especially early 80s, I mean especially that mid 80s time when we kind of appeared, it was a bit of a kind of for guitar groups and stuff, it was a bit of a wasteland, really. And there wasn't, you know, it was good for us in a way we came over because we felt like there's not much competition here. Except there was also the Jesus and Mary Chain were the ones who we probably felt closest to. And they would come and see us. But everybody was usually so drunk and so kind of shy and stuff. And we never really got properly friends with them. But, you know, they were all there on Cocteau Twins. I mean, everybody's, all these other bands, they all come to see us. And they'd all mention us when they went to America and stuff. But, you know, a lot of the British press, they didn't, you know, especially like paper like Melody Maker, they were so, there was something, some kind of agenda there. And I always think maybe that's to do with the politics and stuff as well.
The newspapers of those days, Record Mirror, Sounds, Enemy, that they had so much impact on bands that these days it's difficult to comprehend the actual amount of influence that they had.
Yeah, well, they ended up, you know, it was really funny how they kind of were responsible for their own demise in a way because, you know, they wanted things to happen quicker and quicker, and they would never let anything evolve organically. Like towards the end of the Petrels, you would notice, you know, they were starting to do like personal attacks on musicians and stuff, you know, whatever they look like, or, you know what I mean? It became really, really nasty. Whereas there was no more kind of construct, you know, if you look at the reviews and stuff in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, or even up until punk. time, the criticism was usually constructive, but there was that kind of time where they just felt like they were more important than the band. A lot of these writers, it's such big egos, and they could just destroy a band, so it was like, I'm sure you remember, like, a band would come out and you'd have to be amazing straight away. I mean, I always talk about My Bloody Valentine. I mean, it took them years to kind of get to where they became the proper My Bloody Valentine that people would know about now. Do you know what I mean? They had to go through changes. And the same with Stone Roses. Stone Roses supported us in 1985. And I don't remember them, but they were more gothy then as well. They were sort of whatever was, maybe like a bit like the Cult or something. Do you know what I mean? It was like around that time you could sort of see what they were like. I think if a band's allowed to kind of develop kind of away from the spotlight, it's always going to be better for them, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, the other thing that the press would do a lot is, as soon as a new band came out, they say this is the new big thing, and they'd build them up. Then, as soon as they put them up there, the next job for them was to knock them straight back down again. So they
Well,
kind
it
of said,
happened to
"This is
us,
the
yeah.
new big thing, right? Let's destroy them."
Well, it happened to us. It was like, we were expect after Babel, there was an expectation that we would go up to the next level and become, top 20 and start playing bigger places and stuff. And when that didn't happen, it was like, if you go back and read the review for End of the Millennium, our third record of the Enemy, it gets, I think it's like, they were doing marks in, it was like 8.5 out of 10, which, that's a good mark, isn't it? And you think, well, the review's going to be good. But it read like an obituary. I remember like being really like, it felt like somebody stabbing you through the heart, because
God.
obviously that was a difficult period for us as well.
Just go back to the Manic Pop Thrill.
Yeah, man.
That process of creating that first album, what was that like? Because I always thought that It's a Good Thing should have been like this massive hit.
Yeah, well, it was a stand, it was a standout. I think we never, like, I think every single gig we played It's a Good Thing. I mean, it just sounds fresh even today, I mean, that was a brilliant time. Making that was my favorite record to record. And Hugh Jones was amazing. And we wanted to use him after that, but Polydor didn't want to use him. And I think it came down to his manager. His manager was quite interesting guy. It was really funny. Hugh Jones' manager actually wanted to manage us. And he was saying all the right things. He was saying, "Oh, you're like a young Rolling Stones, young Led Zeppelin, gonna go." He was really talking big and stuff. But I think he turned out to be a bit of a bullshitter in the end. But we ended up, we didn't go with him. So I think that kind of maybe created problems when we wanted to use Hugh again. So it was either him or, he maybe they blamed the record company, but maybe he felt a bit slighted, because we didn't pick him for a manager. But it's a shame because, I mean, I think Hugh was, out of all the people we worked with, my favorite person, my favorite producer by a mile. And I got back in contact with him quite recently, and he said to me that his two favorite records that he made were Manic Pop Thrill and Heaven Up Here, because he said there was both records were greater than the sum of the parts, whatever, And it was a joy. It was a joy to make that record. I mean, we were quite well rehearsed, and we kind of did a lot of it live. We actually brought in a PA. We'd heard that the Stooges did that for Funhouse, so we did that, and there was just a great camaraderie there as well. And we went to Rockfield, and so we were out of London, and that was a bit exciting as well. And it was all done quickly. That's the thing. It was all done pretty quickly. We were on a kind of strict budget, but Rough Trade had, we thought of, the record was going to come out Rough Trade, but then, and we were hanging on for them, and then they said no, and then Demon came in and we went with them instead. signed a terrible deal, which was, we've lost the rights to that record forever, unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a
Well.
bad deal. I mean, I'm a bit annoyed with John and Damien. They should have, like, me and Kieran and Steve obviously had no, idea about stuff like that, but we should have looked at the contract a bit better. But still, at the time, we needed that. We were losing momentum, we lost momentum waiting for Rough Trade to decide, and then they said no, because we were all set up for it, because when V2 came out, that was, it was somebody from Rough Trade that kind of helped us, do it ourselves, and told us what to do or whatever. So we were kind of a little bit reliant on them. So whenever that kind of rug was pulled away, we just went with Demon, because we knew we were losing momentum and everybody was getting a bit antsy.
Yeah, it's interesting because Demon, we've had a couple of bands that have been involved with Demon. One I think was TV21, which I think had a good experience, if I recall. But the Men They Couldn't Hang actually regretted leaving that label. So it's a funny old thing, isn't it? It just sounds
Oh,
like they got a
really?
bad
Right.
deal on that one. Yeah.
Well, it depends. I mean, now they're actually owned, the BBC owns it now. That's who owns the Demon and all their back catalogue. It's the BBC. They just put out, so we went again, finally got a box set, and they were the only ones that were interested in doing it. So we went with them. But I mean, they only did 500, it's just for like true fans. So, and we thought it might get a bit of traction, but again, it just kind of, they didn't do any publicity on it whatsoever. So, I mean, I'm glad it's out there finally. And me and Damien, we did a lot of work, getting the booklet together and stuff and making sure it sounded good. I mean, it actually sounds fantastic. So you can tell. So they're obviously using the BBC studios to remaster and stuff. Like we own Final Flame, so I'm looking into maybe doing that as vinyl. It's never been on vinyl.
That's no, that's got to be a vinyl reissue, surely.
Yeah. Well, we're looking at the kind of logistics set for like next year, maybe next spring or something. It's a really good, it really captured the live sound, which was always a bit of a problem.
Talk to us a little bit about then the closest in terms of getting to a hit, which was Big Decision.
Manic Pathrell did really well. I think it sold about 30,000 copies, which is really good for an independent record. And obviously, all the people who refuse, all the people who wouldn't give us the time of day before Manic Pathrell were now like, we had so many offers from so many majors, and we ended up going with Polydor. And they start off with, they were really good, because we were signed by the MD, a guy called Richard Ogden. So, when you're signed by the MD, then you're given priority. So that's why, we couldn't fault them on the PR and everything that they did for Babel and for Big Decision. So Big Decision got to 43, and the midweek, we got a message in the midweek. There was two records. One would go up and one would go down, and we went down, and the one that went up was Wet, Wet, Wet.
Oh, right.
So the general public voted for Wet, Wet, Wet. And we went, so they went up and we went down, and that was the closest we ever got to the top 40. It didn't seem like a huge sort of slap in the face at the time, because everybody was talking about it. It was NME's top five records of the year, and we were on our uppers, so we thought, well, the next one will do better. We weren't worried about it at all, but that was kind of the peak commercially or whatever. So we went on, we were touring a lot then around Babel. Went to America. We did a UK tour in Ireland, and then we went to America. And then from America, we went straight to Scandinavia. So we came back from Scandinavia, we were all knackered. And in the meantime, this guy, Richard Ogden, he left and became Paul McCartney's personal manager. And this other guy, Munns, he came in and took over. And he had beef. He had previous beef with our manager. Our manager held him out the window of a two-story house. So, immediately it was, he wasn't going to treat us fairly. So he immediately got, he called us in and he was like, what's going on here? I don't hear any hits and stuff, So our manager, he went to get some legal counsel and they found a way of getting out of the contract. And so we've, at the time we were like, oh, we just went, we thought, well, this guy's not horrible. He's not going to really look after us properly. But as I said, it was very short term because we should have waited a bit longer. You know what I mean? Just to see, because the Americans were like really going for, they were actually doing a lot of good PR and we were obviously getting a lot of good press and we had the Rolling Stone thing and stuff. And whenever we went to Virgin, then we lost all that momentum. So we went over there and we're touring, but no record company had any product anymore. So that really, it kind of negated all the good stuff that was happening, really. But then we went to Virgin. We'd recorded Genius Move and Groove Check, supposed to be on Polydor. And then this guy Mons, he obviously didn't like it, didn't think it was good enough. So then when we went to Virgin, then we gave them Genius Move. Then what happened was there was a quote that was on the sleeve of Genius Move, and it was from a man called Liam Fellows, and it was left to our tour manager to hand in the text. The Liam Fellows quote, we had seen it in this book by Gerry Adams, but there was no need to put Gerry Adams' name. But our tour manager, he was English, and he just, I mean, I think he thought he was being thorough. He put Gerry Adams' name, and then we got into trouble because of that. The BBC basically banned Genius Move. At that time, if you remember 1988, that was a time when, they wouldn't, if a Gerry Adams or somebody from Sinn Féin was talking, they'd get the actor in. Do you remember
The
when they did the
voiceover,
actor? And that was just it was a really part, the Tories were really paranoid about Ireland at that stage as well. And I just remember that a guy that personally had a terrible time the second half of 1988. But everything with Genius Move, everything just seemed to go wrong. So they banned Genius Move. They banned, like, the Pogues had a song about the Birmingham Six. They banned that. But instead of telling everybody that they were banning it, like they'd done with Frankie Goes to Hollywood and stuff, and then given that, that's why Frankie Goes to
It gave
Hollywood.
it life.
Yeah, of course it did. So they knew not to do that anymore. So it was just like a tacit ban was on Genius Move. So it just got no airplay. Even though Virgin did their best. So that was disappointing, obviously. And then Millennium came out, and the response to that was, is people didn't know how to react to it, And I think people's tastes were, there was that kind of still, there was a divide between people who like sort of rock music and dance music. And what the idea behind in the Millennium was when we were on tour, we would play music for each other, and we had these compilation tapes that we did, and you have a bit of everything on these compilation tapes, and that was the idea for End of the Millennium, but it just was a couple of years too early. By 1990, people wouldn't have, there wouldn't have been the same kind of confusion about what we were trying to do or whatever, and like the only thing about Virgin asked, they actually stuck on two songs that we weren't that mad about putting on. So End of Millennium was a bit lopsided and a bit too long as well. And there's a couple of tracks that weren't great on it either, I would say now. But I'd say a lot of that record stands up really well, though, in
It has
retrospect.
been sort of almost reappraised, isn't
It
it,
has, yeah.
in
I think
later years?
the fans really like it as well. Even a couple of them
Yeah.
say that's their favorite, you know. And I think, like, if for some reason, I don't know why he didn't put Genius. If he had to put Genius Move on the front of it as well, it would have changed the whole perception of it as well. That was a difficult time because when we went in to make Millennium, like, literally the first night that we were in the studio, because we recorded the first part of it in Rockfield, we went back to Rockfield again, first time since Manic Pop Thrill. And John told us that he was leaving that night. You know, we're all sitting around drinking and stuff, and then he announced that he was leaving. And it just was absolutely devastating, as you can imagine. And I still to this day, I just can't understand why he didn't wait until everything was recorded. So it meant that the whole recording session was, it was just all done under a cloud, you know. And people, everybody started kind of, instead of us four getting together and talking about, you know, what we're going to do and how we're going to deal with this and stuff, everybody kind of went into their own head. And I was drinking and taking a lot of drugs at the time. I ended up in hospital. And so I was kind of out. I was actually taken off the tour and around this time, around September, October. I was really in a bad way. It was just I was out of control anyway. But then this happened as well. Just like, you know, you're thinking, oh God, is it all going to be over now? What are we going to do? Instead of sitting down and thinking, well, you know, caring to myself, like, I already started, you know, we were contributing quite a lot. And like Damien's always good for some songs as well. So we really had nothing to worry about. But of course, young men, you know, not talking to each other, not really saying what they felt and stuff, just it was really bad for a while. And it looked like we were going to break up for a while as well. But that didn't happen, luckily. And we kind of, yeah, so there was some time off. We had to cancel some stuff because I was ill. But then when I was getting a bit better, we started doing some European dates. And then we got John Marchini was my friend from home. And he's a really great personality, very warm and funny. And he was just the right person to kind of cement our friendship again, you know. So we went and did this tour then in America. And spring of 1989, and it was fantastic. We were like a month in America, and obviously there was now three records, you know, so people knew us a little bit. And I mean, the whole tour was fantastic. We did like, I think we did like about 30,000 miles, and but the gigs were fantastic. I remember we played in Atlanta and a lot of college gigs, and I remember like the Atlanta gig, it was sold out. It was like 1,000 people there, and it was like the Beatles or something. They just went mental. And I mean, we were starting to play really, really well again, and we had all this new material that we're excited about. So that was fantastic. So I came back from that tour, everybody was galvanized again, and then we decided to go and do what became Chemi Crazy in Los Angeles, and we were there for 3 months working with Scott Litt.
Oh, from REM fame, I should
Yeah,
say. Yeah. What was
yeah.
that like working with him?
It was hard work actually because we didn't really see eye to eye about a lot of things. He was a bit of a, I think he did a good job. Like, he was obviously, we were under pressure. We were under pressure then to make, you know, to have hits and stuff. But that was never a problem. We always wanted hits. We were always writing commercial material as we thought. So that wasn't so much a problem. But he just cleaned up our sound too much for us, I think. But, you know, he delivered, and it was for the Americans as well, I think. They were pushing. The Americans really wanted this, you know, to be a radio-friendly record, and that's what they were given. But then they didn't do anything with it, you know, so for whatever reason. But Virgin UK and Virgin France were amazing. Now, I can't say a bad word about Virgin the whole time we were there. And we were lucky to have our A&R, head of A&R was a guy, a lovely guy called Wally Richardson, also from Northern Ireland. So that kind of always, you know, bonded us really well as well. And he's just a lovely guy. In fact, he probably should have cracked the whip with us a bit more. He just made things really easy, you know. And then, like, the people that worked at Virgin, they were great. And they would come, you know, on their own time and their own money, come to see us, you know, do gigs in Europe and stuff. You know, they just turn up on the weekend, you know, and it wasn't like for work, it was just because they loved the band, you know. So everybody was behind us, but we just couldn't get through the door. So we had, I think Tingle got the about 43. That was Tingle, Hey Venus, Sensitize, and Abandon. It was a big mistake. Like Abandon was the first one, and that was doing really well because the remix, Andy Weller remix, that was doing really well. And we went on the Late Show, if you remember that. They used to have bands on the Late
Yeah,
Show.
yeah, yeah.
And we should have done Abandon, but we did Sensitize. Our manager wanted us to do Sensitize. And Sensitize had sort of come together in the studio, so we haven't played it live very much, so we were a bit tentative when we were on TV. Whereas if we had done Abandon, it would have been, I think we would have blew the roof off. You know, it was a bad mistake not to do that. But again, so we had the four songs, and again, couldn't get past 43 again. So that put us under more pressure for the next one. And then we took too long making Fireproof. We made a version, and we weren't crazy about it. And then Virgin dropped us in, but they dropped us, but they gave us the tapes of what we had done. So they kind of. Most of that became what actually came out. We had a few more songs. Like we re-recorded some songs that we thought hadn't come out well, and then we had a few more then. So Fireproof's actually really strong. And it was like Fireproof was the number one record in the independent charts as well.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
again, it just didn't go beyond that, you know.
I
And
feel
so
that album definitely is, other than Manic Pop Thrill, you know, I look back now and I think that's got some of the songs on there, Shangri-La, you know, Detonate My Dreams. I mean, they are so strong, you know, really strong. How this wasn't a massive, you know, seller, I
It's
don't
like
know.
our stock, you know, we're talking about the media again in the UK, and I just felt, you know, there was so like we put out Fireproof, and everybody now is in the whole sort of dance thing, and we haven't been successful, so nobody wants to know really. Do you know what I mean? If it had a maybe Fireproof had to come out a year later when the kind of guitar bands all. So basically, we broke up and then guitar bands came back on the Vogue again. So we're always just a little bit out of time. If you're going to be successful, I think it's all they do with right place, right time. You know, you can, if you read, you know, we've all probably read loads of music biogs and stuff, even the Beatles and the Stones. And it's all about right place, right time, and having the right people around you as well. Because I always wonder, because I'm. Just to backtrack a little bit, I said to you, you know, about Alan McGee wanted John to come over and make a record. So I failed to say what happened there. So basically, we came over and we were waiting for Creation, which was Alan and Dick Green. We're waiting for them to say, you can go in and record. And then they put out the Jesus and Mary Chain, and obviously that did really well. And their attention was all taken up with that. And also, they had no money because they're waiting for the money to come in. And that always took, I don't know, 18 months or whatever. So they had no money. And they kept saying to us, can you wait? Can you wait? And it was just came to the point where we couldn't anymore. You know, we were losing momentum. And it was, you know, we just couldn't drag our heels anymore. But I always wonder what would have happened if we had been on Creation, you know, having Alan behind you, especially, you know, telling you how great you were and how you're going to conquer the world, and, you know, standing by you as well, and like, you know, defending you in the press and doing all the things that he was good at.
So I read about the festival you did in Estonia and about the backdrop to that, about them sort of at that time trying to get freedom from the Soviet Union, it being a kind of a glasnost thing. So, and I think you paid to tens of thousands of people, but that must have been an amazing atmosphere. I mean, the whole sense of the place must have felt quite special.
It was an amazing. The whole trip was amazing. I mean, getting into the country, because like a Russian, so we had to go by sea, and of course I was still drinking a lot, and I was a bit out of control. I nearly got us all arrested a few times, but we finally got there, and it was amazing because our management had sent a video of Genius Move, which is that underwater video, which is really actually quite fun. And so for preparation for all the bands coming over and stuff, you know, they were playing a video of each band, you know, on TV before. And we didn't know about this. So we just decided by chance to start with Genius Move that night. So there was like 90,000 people there. I mean, you know, within the confines of this, you know, it's a huge stadium. You know, when we were there that night, you had no idea about what it was like outside. We found out the next day what it was like. So we went on stage and we started playing Genius Move. They went absolutely bananas, you know. So that was fantastic. That was so good. So we were buzzing from that. But then the people were so nice, but they hated the Russians. They just couldn't wait to get rid of them, you know. And the Russians had polluted a lot of the seas and the rivers and stuff. I remember because we went. we were going to try and have a walk by the sea or whatever, but it was so polluted, it stank to high heaven, so we had to turn
Oh,
back.
wow.
Remember that? And then, you get into the lift because we had this mess, right? We were given these rubles to spend. But I remember I went out the next day looking to kind of spend some of the money, get some souvenirs or something. And went down to this marketplace and like all the shop fronts, and they had nothing in them. Honestly, I remember when I came back and I remember going to my, corner shop and just marveling at the amount of stuff that this corner shop could give you after town. They had nothing, honestly. I remember it's like an old woman was selling a watch, but all the pieces of the watch were all separated, and that was all she had. She had a wee table and she was selling this watch. And so when we left, we couldn't spend the money, so we had a there's a couple of people who were kind of there to kind of look after us and accompany us and
Yeah.
just take us around places, and we ended up giving them all the money that the per diems or whatever it was that we couldn't spend. And this woman just started crying, and
Oh,
it turned
wow.
out what we'd given her was about 8 months' wages or something, for them.
Wow.
For us it was just like change or whatever,
Yeah,
but for
yeah.
her it was like 8 months' wages. But then Estonia has done so well now since they got their independence. They've really, even in the late 90s, I think, all the kids were going there. It was a kind of big sort of techno scene or a dance scene. So people were flying from here. They'd go and spend the weekend in Tallinn, and go dancing and stuff, and then come back, go partying. So, and then, they've just done so well, I think. So I'm really, really happy about that, because it really broke my heart to see the struggles that they were having,
Going back to John Peel then, so he obviously you did two or three sessions with him. How critical was he to you guys? Obviously he was a massive supporter of the Undertones anyway, we know that, but what impact did that have on you?
He gave us a session, so that was great. By the time a big decision. What do we see? I say by the time of Millennium, then we never had another session after that with him. He was really good. I mean, he came to a gig in Camden one time, and then he wrote a review in the Observer, I think it was. Yeah, it was a Sunday Observer, and it was very complimentary and stuff. But it was always his love is for the Undertones. That's his thing.
So, do you look back at, in terms of is there a standout track that you've written that with the band that you look back on and think, I'm really proud of that?
I think maybe Sweet Sugar Bird is probably my favorite.
Sunset tears, this crummy town will squeeze you. Cling to fears, ones you've always known. It's hard to part with, truth be told, I just can't explain. Stand and wait, not at fate. It's too late, now you've been smothered.
Because it was just the whole writing of that song and the recording of it was easy, and a lot of people really, really loved that song. I remember a guy, it was a guy I know, when he was getting married up in Leeds, and he asked me to come up and sing it for his at his wedding party, so I did that. And then I remember when Chemi Crazy came out, about 6 months later, we got this letter from these American kids, and one of their friends had died young, obviously died very, very young and maybe tragically. But this song, this became their song, that kind of helped them through their grief and stuff. So that was really beautiful. So we did Fireproof, and again, we made some bad decisions. So before Fireproof, so whenever Virgin dropped this, there was an option for Virgin France to still be with them. And our manager told us that we should do it independent. And it was a bad decision because we were starting to do really well in France, playing to quite big audiences. And it was a stupid, stupid thing to do because, if you do it by yourself, then everybody has to kind of be behind it. You got to work a bit harder by yourself. We had independent pluggers. We went through that same kind of route that all the major people were using, and it was the wrong thing to do. So we say we had a number one, so it sold really well the first 4 weeks or whatever. But I think then we went on tour, and we were just starting to play to smaller audiences, not tiny audiences, but like it was smaller audiences, and it became like, and we went to Europe as well, and we were doing well in Europe. But in the UK, it was like, as a city, it's that thing about people's perception of the band was like, people's perception was they're on their way out, So we got to the end of the year. So this is Fireproof came out 93. So we get to December 93, and we hear that there's a possibility of an Australian tour. So that kind of gets everybody excited again. So we do all these interviews and all these phoners, at weird hours of the day because of the time difference. And then we're supposed to be going in January. And then the night before we're supposed to go, it turns out the promoter was dodgy and the tickets didn't come through. So the whole thing got cancelled. And that just broke our hearts. I think it broke me and Kieran more than the rest of them. I mean, what we should have done was just take a year off because we were kind of sick of each other as well. We're living in each other's pockets and seeing each other for so long. We really just should have taken, we shouldn't have said we're breaking up. We should have said we're taking a break and we'll come back in a year and see how we feel. And I'm sure if we had done that, we would have continued because, none of us did anything straight away. By the end of 94, Damien said to me, "Oh, we should start doing music again." And we had a project, me and Damien and Brendan had a project called Wave Walkers for a year and a half. And we played like, so we had the first gig we did as the Wave Walkers, it was in France, was in Paris, in this beautiful little theater. And it was like 500 people there. And it felt like, the gig went brilliantly as well. So I thought, oh, we're off again. But then it just didn't work out. And again, with lots of bad luck. And then I took a break for a while. I started working for BT. But I was still always writing music. And I mean, I had the songs, like the songs from the Wave Walkers are, some of those songs are on the two Everlasting Yeah records. There's loads of material still around. Kieran's got loads of stuff, loads of songs as well. So we were doing, Kieran and I were doing kind of acoustic, we were doing acoustic thing together up the West End. We did that for about 9 months and then that kind of fizzled out. So it was always, things were always fizzling out. And then we'd see Steve, he'd come over every couple of years, or whatever, and maybe bring up the subject of getting back together. But nobody was really up for it. And then Damien was obviously starting to play for the Undertones again. But then in 2007, Steve came over and I think we got an offer to reform and play in this really great festival in Ireland called the Electric Picnic. And so we decided to do that. And it went so well. Then we did like some gigs in 2008, 2009. And we were actually thinking of talking about, doing another recording. Everything was going really well. But then Steve's wife at the time, she got pregnant. And so the last gig, we were in New York, end of 2009, just around Christmas. And Steve told us that he didn't want to do it anymore. So it was like, what? Like you've been cheerleading this whole thing, So that was really annoying. But then, so we decided, the four of us decided to kind of keep going because we were enjoying playing together again. So that's how the Everlasting Yeah happened. And
So that's how it started, the Everlasting Year. That's how that kind of came about, which obviously is like your current thing.
yeah, I mean, I'm more excited about the Everlasting Yeah and it's so exciting to be putting out records again. And unfortunately, we can't really play live, which is a bummer because of like, Kieran just can't doing at the moment. He's got problems with his hand. He's waiting on an operation. And it's just like, I think if we, when we, when or if we do play again, it'll be a kind of different thing. We're going to have to do it maybe more semi-acoustic, and we can't do the full-on Sonic Assault anymore. So there's lots of good things, but I think a Pedals now, I'd be really surprised if we ever played again, to be honest. There's
You think
no,
they're done and dusted, do you?
yeah, I do, because we couldn't do that kind of Sonic Assault thing, you know. It's like, because it's the great thing with Everlasting, yeah, is it's not as loud and it's not as kind of frantic. It's a lot more laid back.
If you look back now, what's your favorite memory of your time with the band? What would you say that is?
There's a lot of different ones. I'd probably say that American tour, you know, like after Millennium, as I was saying, you know, we went through that really rough patch. It looked like we might even be breaking up. So that tour we did after that in America, you know, we were away for like a month. And I mean, the gigs were just fantastic, and we were rebonding as friends again as well. Because I think a lot to do with our musical relationship was to do with our friendship as well, and the fact that we never made any money and never had to fight about money is the reason for a continuing friendship. With Everlasting, yeah, we tend to sort of jam a little bit more than the Pedrals would have done, and it's just looser and it's more fun. But there's just that great connection, you know. It's like you don't have to say things a lot of time, you know. So yeah, that American tour I would say was my favorite. The Atlantic gig that I mentioned, but I mean, you know, there was loads of other stuff as well. Unfortunately, it's weird. You'd think like I would remember doing the main stage of Glastonbury twice, but I can't hardly remember it at all.
Thank you for your time, Raymond. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Really interesting. Yeah, great stuff.
Thanks very much today. Take care, chaps.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, correct us on anything, then you can of course contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.co.uk.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, The Uncharted 80s. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you. Thank you.